wanna see my picture on the cover. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Reading today from the Rolling Stone magazine, the April 2025 edition. In the random notes section of the magazine, Indie Darling, Another Side of Samia, the acclaimed singer-songwriter searches for her true self and shakes off sexist expectations on her bold new album. Step into Samia's fantasy world and you'll find an alter ego that looks like her, but is entirely different. She wears a backward baseball cap on top of her long, curly, jet black hair and sports denim Daisy Dukes. She lives in a balmy, emerald greened wetland. She's completely unburdened by people's opinions or expectations. This is Samia's idealized self, and her name is Kiki Swamp. As she shares her alter ego's name, Samia, age 28, can't help but laugh. I made a sim of her, the singer-songwriter says with a chuckle, is like the most confident version of myself. Samia is worlds away from her daydream as she sits at a corner table at the Grand Central Oyster Bar in Manhattan. It's mid-February, and a blanket of snow covers New York. This version of Samia describes herself as a pretty naturally shy person as she picks apart her straw wrapper and fiddles with the gold rings on her fingers. She sips on an iced tea with a plate of French fries in front of her. She's too nervous to try an oyster for the first time. What if it went poorly? And then it was documented forever. Fair enough. Throughout the conversation, she often says she feels like a child. It's a funny comparison when you consider the very unchildlike music she makes, pairing searing lyrics with potent melodies. Or her killer outfit, an elegant, dark brown fur coat thrown over a black mini dress paired with platform loafers. Samia may not be in the Kiki Swamp uniform, but as she gears up to release her third album named Bloodless, she's closer to that idealized self than ever before. That's not to say her first two albums, 2020's The Baby and 2023's Honey, lacked confidence. Those records showed off her superpower, sharp songwriting with incisive details about heartbreak and 20-something life. I hope you marry the girl from your hometown, and I'll fucking kill her. It's a skill she's been honing since around 2017, when she first started playing open mics in New York. Samia quickly found an audience back then, connecting with fans who could picture her vivid imagery and see their own experiences reflected back at them. For the album Bloodless, Samia realized she had to turn away from the need for outside approval. She says, "It doesn't come naturally for me. I'm not one of those people who's like, fuck what you think. I was really on a mission to shed that part of myself because I thought, the only way I'll ever be happy is if I learn to believe in my choices and ideas." Since this past December, Samia has lived in Minneapolis with her boyfriend and fellow musician, Briston Maroney. Before that, the couple spent time in Los Angeles, where she was born to actor parents Kathy Najimy and Dan Finnerty, and in Nashville, where Maroney was based. But she says the new album's Americana feel and folk-pop leanings come into focus on a pivotal recording trip that she took in August 2023 to Western North Carolina. She says, "I think the spirit of it was born there. That's when I sort of understood what I was trying to say." Samia had been formulating the poems that would become the album Bloodless earlier that year, starting with a concept revolving around historical muses like Kiki D. Montparnasse, an early 20th century artist model for surrealist painter Man Ray, and others. But she found herself changing course to write about how she, herself, was perceived by the world. It started with the party Samia sings about on the song Lizard, a night that was ruined by the presence of a no-contact person in my life, she says. We had a conversation to try to remedy the situation, and the next day we had to go to a party together with all of our mutual friends, mostly his friends, and it was horrible. Samia says that painful encounter helped her tap into one of the new album's central themes. She says when you don't talk things through, there's just a lot of fantasy being created. I was feeling the consequences of being made into a fantasy and not being able to have a chance to explain myself and be a human being. She felt like a mythologized monster, and it pissed her off. Samia soon realized her frustration extended beyond that specific conflict. She says, I started thinking about my experience with womanhood on a larger scale. I had so much shame about being worried about men and maybe having altered myself in some way because of it. That's a theme she's been working on through for years. Some of her earliest singles, like Someone Tell the Boys and Lasting Friend, boldly called out mansplainers and handsy young men, cementing the singer-songwriter as a feminist voice. As she continued writing the album Bloodless, Samia saw how universal her feelings were and how often women have to shape and contort themselves to appease men. Even if you don't like boys, you just have to make men not kill you, she says. You have to appeal to men in some way. Samia makes sure to clarify that she's not talking about one man in her life. She says, I keep calling it this conglomerate, patchwork, abstract idea of a man. Throughout the LP, Samia deals with the horrific realities of a patriarchal society by poking fun at the unattainable expectations put on women. Picking leeches off white underwear, I want to be impossible, she sings on the lead single, Bovine Excision, subverting the idea of virginity by claiming she's so incredibly, unrealistically pure that even leeches sucking on her skin wouldn't draw a drop of blood. On album highlight Hole in the Wall, Samia finds there can be power in being an empty vessel for other people's ideas of what you represent, using a piece of music history as a metaphor. The framed spot in Kane's Ballroom in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Sid Vicious punched a hole in the wall in 1978. It was just the most perfect fucking metaphor, the frame around nothing, she says. It was this absence that he created. The six-minute spiral of an album closer, Pants, explores a similar idea as Samia contends with her identity. She says, who was I when I bought these pants? They're non-refundable now. Now I'm questioning everything I am. She sings breathlessly over a steady drum beat before the track transforms into a moody meditation. Want to see what's under these Levi's? I got nothing under these Levi's. Samia repeatedly taunts as the song ends. Get it? There's no woman under the pants, she tells me, laughing. There's relief and joy in that absurd moment, as she releases not just her most personal album, but also her most ferocious one, and stakes a claim in a new Midwest city, Samia is free to shape whoever she wants to be. Maybe I'm just all of these things, she says. Whatever I started with, there is somewhere, and then all these little things that have attached themselves to me are there. She leans her head against the wood-paneled wall of the restaurant as she considers this possibility and all that it implies. She says, maybe there is no inherent self. The thing that I've been so desperately looking forward to reconnect with, it might not be there. And that's fine. That's kind of exciting. Also in random notes, Almost Famous. Everybody likes Ike, even if they can't recognize him. A shopping trip and lunch date with Ike Barinholtz, unsung hero of 2+ decades of comedy. As Ike Barinholtz approaches the register at Farm Boy Produce, the cashier regards the 48-year-old comic actor, writer, director with a gimlet-eyed skepticism, as if he's a shoplifter or worse. Are you famous? For a moment, Barinholtz can only smile. Finally, he musters, "Do you think I am?" The question hangs over a grocery run with Barinholtz. The Chicago native is on a mission to make me, a Brooklyn boy, a chopped cheese, the classic bodega sandwich, with ingredients from L.A.'s Fairfax Farmers Market. But Barinholtz is a gourmet interpreted. A woman raises her phone and snaps a photo of him paying for kielbasa. "I'm going to send it to my husband," she says. "If you're famous, he would know." He's asked whether he's famous by customers at Kalen and Kalen Pickles and Huntington Meats. One of the market's security guards and a passing shopper who takes a photo with Barinholtz just in case he turns out to be somebody. "Maybe he thinks I'm John Cena, coming back from the woods," says Barinholtz, who sports a bushy beard, work boots, and a Carhartt jacket. Or that Mark Wahlberg got doughy. Two people, however, instantly identify Barinholtz, a pair of agency bigwigs leaving a breakfast meeting. One makes a beeline and bro hugs him. This form of fame-ishness, it seems, is Barinholtz's brand, often recognized by face, name, or project, but rarely all three, yet well-known among insiders. His skills have made him a comic actor's comic actor, a writer's writer, and a baton carrier of comedy legends like Mel Brooks and Norman Lear. He has written for and appeared in Mad TV, The Mindy Project, and History of the World Part II, acting in broad films like Neighbors, Blockers, and Suicide Squad, and written, directed, and starred in The Oath. After slow cooking for more than two decades, Barinholtz's career is starting to simmer. He co-created, with Mindy Kaling, the recent Netflix comedy Running Point, starring Kate Hudson as a genie bus type who takes over a family-owned basketball franchise. And he's about to become more recognizable than ever with this studio, Apple TV's send-up of Hollywood movie-making, now streaming. Barinholtz stars along the show's co-creator, Seth Rogen, as Sal Saperstein, a hot mess studio exec prone to excess. Barinholtz's own vice is filling a half dozen grocery bags and counting. "I have an eating problem. I do," he says. "I take Ozempic, but cut it with French fries." Shopping without a list, he is exacting, however. He bypasses baguettes in favor of Italian loaves and pushes aside little gem lettuce, stating, "Too fancy. Iceberg. This ain't going to be no woke chopped cheese." A few minutes' drive away, Barinholtz unpacks the makings of our lunch on his kitchen counter and starts slicing with speed and skill. Barinholtz cooks dinners five times a week for his wife and kids. He'll be making Chicago-style Italian beef hoagies for an upcoming party. He wasn't asked to bring anything. He told the host what would be served. A frequent dinner guest, Seth Rogen marvels at Barinholtz's culinary precision and commitment to craft. "It's the same with comedy," says Rogen, who likens Barinholtz to a jazz musician whose improvisational skill is built atop technique and attention to detail. It made Barinholtz invaluable in the studio. "The way we shot the show was as hard as anything I've ever done, and he ate it up. Sorry," Seth Rogen says. Comedy and cooking have always gone hand in hand for Barinholtz. Growing up, when he'd hang out at the home of his friend David Stassen, now his writing and producing partner, Stassen would play Nintendo, while Barinholtz buried himself in Stassen's parents' copies of Bon Appetit. They gorged on movies, too, hard comedies like Blazing Saddles and Trading Places, and mafia sagas, particularly Goodfellas. Perhaps not coincidentally, the film doubles as a cooking lesson. Amid a cocaine-fueled mania, Ray Liotta's Henry Hill shares how to make Sunday gravy. Prison scenes show Polly, played by Paul Sorvino, slicing garlic with a razor blade, and delivering a line Barinholtz says defines his weight loss plan: "We gotta go on a diet. Tomorrow we eat sandwiches." The movie's comedic edge struck him. I always thought if I ever met Marty Scorsese, I've got to tell him, "Goodfellas made me want to do this," Barinholtz says. Cut to 30-what years later. Scorsese makes a memorable appearance in the first episode of The Studio. One scene called for Sal to lay the most ass-kissy line possible on the legendary director, who knew precisely what it should be. Scorsese goes, "Well, people always come up to me and say, 'You're the reason why I got into movies.'" Barinholtz recalls with a wince. Luckily, self-abasement comes easily to Barinholtz. After Sal delivers the salvo, Scorsese responds, "Who the fuck are you?" Seth Rogen wrote Sal with Barinholtz in mind and says the actor gave notes and pitched fixes that saved skeins. It helped that Rogen and his creative partner Evan Goldberg have a similar approach as Barinholtz and Stassen. "We like stupid people saying stupid things in 9 seconds," Barinholtz says. "We just want hard jokes." Barinholtz sets down a butcher board loaded with a resplendent chopped cheese sandwich. Nearby, framed photos showcase moments with celebrities and family, including his father, erstwhile attorney Alan Barinholtz, who had a role in the 2023 comedy Jury Duty as Judge Alan Rosen. Ike recounts a fan approaching them on the street and bypassing him to press the flesh with his dad. "I love that for him," Barinholtz says, laughing. "Fucking Nepo parent." In Rolling Stone's feature, Future of Music, meet the artists who have us most excited about the music of tomorrow. Turning to the artist Wonder Horse, the UK band keeps getting comparisons to rock legends, and they deserve every one. Wonder Horse frontman Jacob Slater's Wi-Fi is spotty. "Fucking nightmare on my end," he says. He's taken this Zoom call from the south of Morocco, where he spent the past 4 Januaries surfing and doing nothing else. The 28-year-old UK musician has grown accustomed to this kind of reset every so often. After his rambunctious but short-lived stint as the frontman of the post-punk trio Dead Pretties came to an end in 2017, he took refuge on the coast of Cornwall, England, doing odd jobs, working as a surfing instructor, and taking a part as the Sex Pistols drummer in the TV miniseries Pistol. "It was kind of a baptism by fire," he recalls at the time. "Dead Pretties formed when I was 17, and by the time I was 20, it was all gone." He remembers the following years as quiet and intense, during which he came down from some bad habits he developed. "I think it's been published someplace. Ah, he went teetotal. He went sober. It's not quite the case, but I just didn't indulge myself in those ways. It was getting in the way of my own life, and definitely in the way of creativity." Wonder Horse began in 2020 as a solo project, before Slater recruited old friends Harry Fowler on guitar, Jamie Stiples on drums, and Pete Wooden on bass. The band's second album, Midas, has drawn glowing reviews with its dark and distinctive melodies and rupturing guitar riffs. Rolling Stone's John Dolan spoke for many years when he described Midas's title track as Nirvana in utero crossed with Radiohead's The Bends. Slater's response to those lofty comparisons, "I'll take that," he says. Spotlight on another artist, Jim Legacy. Stormy emotions and memories powers his songs. The London-based musician Dim Legacy makes effervescent songs rooted in feeling. His 2023 mixtape, Homeless Naga Pop Music, deployed samples like globs of glitter spread across a poster board, dousing the emotional turbulence that inspired the project. "I've always struggled with religion," Jim explains over Zoom. "But I feel like whenever I make a song where I'm connecting to how I feel, it generally feels like God is in the room. Now he's preparing his follow-up mixtape titled Black British Music, set to be released later this year. Jim's parents moved to the UK from Nigeria, and he says that the project is an effort to carve out a musical identity for other first-generation black Brits. Our identity is still at a point where it's malleable, he says. We're figuring out what that is. He's been working on the project for more than 2 years, allowing songs to gestate until they feel timeless. I feel like I'm trying to make things that are reminiscent of a different time in music, but I want them to exist in this time, he adds. It's a difficult task, but I believe I can do it. It's quite epic. I can't lie. Spotlight in another artist in the future of music, Medium Build. He's finding lots of fans with his indie folk tunes, but he's got much more than that on his mind. When Nick Carpenter released Country, his major label debut as Medium Build last year, all his dreams seemed to be coming true. He's been self-releasing strange, dark little songs under that name on Bandcamp for nearly a decade before Country found him playing at festivals and large theaters around the world. There's only one problem. There's a part of Carpenter, age 33, that wants to run very far from the niche he successfully carved out for himself. I put out an Americana, indie folk thing, called it Country as a Joke, that somehow gets me the attention of the Noah Kahn, Zach Bryan crowd, he says. Now I'm like, yeah, I like to scare some people away or bring in new fans. I'm scared to just be a white guy with an acoustic guitar. That would be my nightmare. I want to make more challenging stuff than I've been invited to make. Medium Build's music combines the vocal textures of R&B crooners like Omar Apollo and Frank Ocean with the emo tendencies of Dashboard Confessional and Fall Out Boy with a fine-tuned songcraft of mainstream country. The best reference point might be the entire Odd Future Collective rolled up into one guy who has also spent a few years in Nashville writing rooms and sweaty DIY venues. Carpenter debuted the project in 2015 with Stupider, an almost off-putting forthcoming song that begins with a verse about masturbating into a sock. In My Room, his portrait of pubescent angst is a good example of his lyrical style on country. TGI Monday, I can see my friends again. I quote the Matrix so I seem interesting. That general hopping versatility and widely open attitude has gotten Medium Build opening gigs for everything from Tyler Chitters to Lewis Capaldi, as well as a spot on this year's Coachella. Carpenter is only beginning to envision his next album, but as he looks forward to what's next, he tries to keep his sky-high ambition in check. This dream is to be relevant, to add to the conversation, he says, but you have to be able to talk yourself off the cliff. Also spotlighted in the Future of Music 25, the artist Megan Maroney. She's a Gen Z country queen with an inimitable way of telling stories about love in the internet age. Amazingly, she got kind of a late start. There it is, Megan Maroney says, looking out of the tour bus window while slipping on white cowboy boots and a camo hooding, the promised land. The sun is setting over endless rows of gas pumps on a windy January night in Crossville, Tennessee. Six massive fluorescent letters and a cartoon beaver in a red cap illuminate our way. We've arrived at that roadway mecca common to the southern United States, Buc-ee's. The overstimulation hasn't started yet, she warns me, as we walk into the massive chain store, which is sort of like a gas station crossed with a Home Goods plus a pinch of Disneyland. It's my first time at a Buc-ee's, and I'm getting the Megan Maroney tour. Where should I take you first, she asks, scanning about. The home section over here, but I'm going to save that for later. Maroney scurries by Buc-ee's branded Squishmallows, Louis Vuitton duped handbags, and mounds of beef jerky as customers discreetly turn their heads to watch her hot pink hat weave through the aisles. It's not long before a mom in a hoodie and sweats approaches Moroni. "Excuse me," she says sheepishly. "I don't mean to be a pain, but my daughter wanted me to ask. Are you Megan?" "I am," Moroni responds with a grin, spotting a shy teenager opposite the aisle with pickled quail eggs. "Tell her to come on over." The girl hugs Moroni before posing for a photo. Once the first brave fan says hello, other shoppers follow suit. For them, it's hard to believe that the Country Music Association's New Artist of the Year is at a Buc-ee's on a random Friday night, buying bedazzled wine glasses and a kitchen towel bearing the phrase, "Queen of Damn Near Everything." But Buc-ee's is near and dear to the rising star's heart. When I used to tour in the rental cars and church vans, finding a Buc-ee's was like you hit gold on the road, she says with a laugh. Right now, Moroni's on her way from a songwriting session in Crossville to a gig opening for Alan Jackson in Oklahoma City, and she's dropping me off in Nashville on the way. We pulled up to the Buc-ee's in the brand new bus she'll bring on the road for tour dates that stretch through October, and she's just starting to decorate it. Later, she'll proudly display her purchases, a cow-shaped sponge she hangs over the sink, and a cast-iron pan she slides into her drawer, even though no one on the tour cooks. "Our only weapon on the bus," she jokes. The house on wheels is the nicest Moroni's ever gotten. It has sliding electric doors, a vanity mirror, a walk-in closet with Moroni's white dress for a show tomorrow, and a fake fireplace heater she's excited to show me. Things have changed since those days of rental cars and church vans. In 2022, the singer's career skyrocketed after she released Tennessee Orange, a tender ballad about putting aside her family's college football loyalties for a boy who treats her well. Its sweet lyrics, "He ain't from where we're from, but he feels like home," spawned a TikTok trend that would lead to offers from 18 different labels. She ended up signing to Sony Music Nashville, Columbia. Moroni has built her profile as a prolific songwriter with a rough-hewn voice reminiscent of early Miley Cyrus. She has an inimitable way of telling stories about love in the internet age while staying true to country music roots. "You say that your phone's going to die? Then you just go put it on silent," she sings over the banjo and steel guitar on "I Know You." She's song-oriented. "She couldn't care less about being a celebrity," says Kenny Chesney, for whom Moroni opened last year. "She cares what her music means to people and making sure they get the best of everything she does." Moroni, age 27, may have built an audience by posting TikToks of herself singing in the car, but now she's learning how to feed the genre's old-school radio machine, crafting songs that fit seamlessly on FM airways. Like a 6'2" dream, heaven sent, he says what he means, and he means what he says. "And he's funny, and he's smart, and he's good in," she coyly crones on the radio hit, "Am I Okay?" So far, she released a pair of excellent albums, won CMA and ACM awards, and has collected for fans like the likes of Tate McRae, Lana Del Rey, and Olivia Rodrigo, who came to her 2023 show at the Troubadour in L.A. and sang along to every word of her songs. "She's brave as fuck," says Sugarland's Kristen Bush, Moroni's go-to producer of her songwriting. "I can't believe she puts some of these things in her songs." Moroni's appeal isn't just emotion and lyrics, however. Aesthetically, she's a Southern Belle Barbie. She styles her wavy blonde hair with 10 pounds of extensions and a hairspray glued poof on special occasions, and pairs mini dresses with her signature white boots. She's fun to watch and connects with both girls who want to be like her and guys who might want to be with her. It's the juxtaposition of my vulnerable, emotional songs with someone that looks very put together and over the top, Moroni says. "This is who I am." And if that's the barrier that makes you not want to listen to my music, then Moroni shrugs. While Moroni began playing guitar at a young age, she didn't even try to write a song until she was in college, making her something of a late bloomer. "I've worked my ass off," she says, but I will say that the positive things that have happened quicker than I expected them to, which is nice. It's funny, because this used to be a hobby for me, and now it's my whole life. A few days before our Bucky's visit, Maroney and I met at Sky House Nashville, the 25-story apartment building near Music Row that Maroney moved into after graduating from the University of Georgia. This is where it all started for her in 2020. She had her first writing sessions here over Zoom and penned Why Johnny, a poignant ballad about Johnny and June Carter Cash's relationship that appears on her 2023 debut, Lucky. Maroney hasn't been back to Sky House in years, but as soon as she arrives this morning, dressed in navy sweats and Uggs, the memories come rushing back. I just ran in and hugged the door guy, Maroney says, of a smiling, bald man named Bob, who takes me in the elevator to meet Maroney. Me and Megan, he says, when we get to the ninth floor, we go way, way back. The Maroney that Bob, the doorman, first met was a lifestyle influencer who wanted to make music. When she arrived in Nashville in the thick of the pandemic, Maroney already had an online presence as a content creator built around her photogenic sorority girl lifestyle at the University of Georgia. She jokes that her Instagram stories would often go from a clip of her playing the guitar to an ad encouraging her followers to use my code for 20% off. She was pushing everything from beauty products to Bud Light bottles to a following of more than 60,000 people. Working as an influencer helped pay the bills. Maroney says she sometimes covered a month's rent with a single video and gave her a leg up in finding her creative voice. I could do pretty much anything because I was making money on the internet rather than having a 9-to-5 job, she says, switching between sips of her caramel cream cold brew and an Elaine new energy drink, her latest brand, Collab. If I had a marketing job out of college, I wouldn't have the freedom and mental space to get good at songwriting. Maroney grew up in Douglasville, Georgia, 20 miles outside of Atlanta. She got her first guitar as consolation from her dad, following a heartbreak that felt like you're falling off a cliff, she says. It was a Taylor, and she still has the guitar. Her dad, who played in a band but kept a full-time job in sales, spent hours teaching her chords. Long after, she injured her knee while doing cheer and was forced to recover in a wheelchair for 2 months. I was like, the guitar fits here, she says, pointing to her good leg. I had nothing else to do. Music was always playing in the Maroney household. I was like 7 years old, and my dad would be like, did you know that the songwriting wrote it like this, and this is why? He was passionate about the stories and lyrics, she says. Her dad put her on to the Eagles, James Taylor, and Jackson Browne. She loved watching Hannah Montana singing to Miranda Lambert in the shower and was, scratch that is, a loyal believer. Before attending one of Justin Bieber's shows, a young Megan handmade shirts that read, dudes are lining up because they hear we got fever, but we kick them to the curb unless they look like Jay Bieber, a play on Keisha's TikTok. Looking back, maybe she thought she'd be like her dad, balancing a pastime with a real job. But a career in music? I don't think it ever clicked in my head that this would be possible, she says. In 2016, Maroney enrolled at the University of Georgia, planning to become an accountant like her mom. During her freshman year, she rushed Kappa Delta and was lured by peer pressure and a Chick-fil-A gift card, unknowingly began her country journey. Maroney tells the story with a giggle. None of her Kappa Delta sisters wanted to compete in the annual Miss Sorority Row pageant, so they offered her fried chicken to represent them. It was like $200, Maroney says. That's going to get me far. Maroney ended up winning the crown, thanks to her rendition of Dina Carter's Strawberry Wine. It was terrifying, and so out of my comfort zone, she says of the pageant. I think it was kind of rigged. I kissed one of the judges. A few months passed, and Maroney, already obsessed with Kacey Musgraves' debut album, Same Trailer, Different Park, found herself on stage again when Kappa Delta needed an opener for a charity event. In the crowd that night was a country singer, Chase Rice, who approached her after the show. "You're actually pretty good," she remembers Rice telling her. "What are you doing next month?" "I play at the Georgia Theater." "Will you bring all these girls with you and you can open up the first of three?" Maroney couldn't say no. Even if there was a catch, she'd have to perform at least one original song. She never even tried to write before. "You're going to pull your boots up and do it," she remembers telling herself, and wrote "Stay a Memory" for the performance. She hasn't put the pen down since. "They say you get the bug," she says, and the bug was got. With the adrenaline rush still fresh, Maroney changed the direction of her studies. She enrolled in Georgia's music business program, led by Drive-By Truckers producer David Barbie, and honed her songwriting while learning music business basics. She carried herself with quiet confidence and never seemed like anybody's helpless bo peep, Barbie says. In between classes, Maroney would send him snippets of songs she wrote. "The songs connected on an emotional level instantly," Barbie recalls. For her final semester, Barbie recommended her for an internship at the studio of Sugarland's Christian Bush and his brother Brandon. Eventually, Maroney played Christian some of her music. He was entranced. Maroney had a smoky voice, similar to his friend Melissa Etheridge, and she could accentuate her delivery with cracks on command. If you put that break in the right place of an emotional lyric, you don't need a recording studio to break a heart, Bush says. You can just break it right in front of someone's face. Bush and Maroney recorded a few demos, including her first single, Wonder, which ended up on the desk of Julie Griffith, the Nashville exec Bush had worked with on his solo music. He sent no headshot or description of Maroney, just the music. "I can't remember when somebody made me feel that way, especially a female voice," Griffin recalls. "I just fell in love with it, and he still wouldn't tell me what she looked like. Am I going to get a 700-pound auger? Why will he not tell me?" Bush set up a Zoom call for Maroney and Griffin to finally meet. Griffith was wowed by the songwriter's creative vision. "If you knew she was blonde and she looked up her Instagram influencer thing in a bikini, you wouldn't have taken her seriously," Griffith remembers Bush telling her. "And I go, you're probably right. He let me fall in love with the songs and the voice before I saw the image." It's the sort of thing that Maroney still hears today. There are people that are like, "Oh, this Barbie doll can't have much depth to her," she says. "It doesn't bother me when people say it, because if you listen to my music, that's the opposite of the truth." For the next 2 years, Maroney kept grinding, writing songs with her partners Griffith suggested. Her debut EP, 2022's Pistol Made of Roses, caught the attention of Spotify, which selected Maroney for their Fresh Finds program just in time for college football season. She had the perfect song for the platform to promote Tennessee Orange, which she announced with a mysterious Instagram photo while wearing a University of Tennessee t-shirt. The song found an audience on TikTok and made a slew of fans eager to know whose Vols shirt that was. Maroney wouldn't admit it right away, but the shirt belonged to Morgan Wallen, who Maroney was involved with briefly in 2020. It's one of those things where, of course, they're going to wonder, "I write songs that people can dream up in their head and think that this is who it's about," she says. She prefers to keep the details of her relationship with Wallen to herself. "As much as it is my story, it's their story too. And I just have respect for the other artists because they're public too," says Maroney, who remains friendly with Wallen. Lucky arrived in May 2023, trailed by a successful single, I'm Not Pretty, about an ex's new girlfriend stalking her Instagram. "I think the algorithm was just set up to where if the lyrics were related to the person that was going through that, then it would show up on their For Your page," she says. "I found that specifically with I'm Not Pretty, a lot of people are like, I don't like country music, but I started listening because of you." Lucky introduced Maroney, calls her emo cowgirl aesthetic an ultra-specific Gen Z perspective that connected with fans not bound by a genre label. Rolling Stone ranked it the number one country album of 2023. There are clever lines throughout, like, "I sleep on my side and you sleep with everyone," and quintessential country ones like, "Who's gonna break down first, this Mustang or me?" But it's "Girl in the Mirror," a self-reflection in which she admits, "You can't love the boy more than you love the girl in the mirror," that hits the hardest at her concerts. I've had dads cry at meet and greets and say they're so grateful for my music. If they didn't have my songs, they wouldn't feel as close to their daughters, Maroney says. If I have a migraine before I go to them with inspiration, the women have written 6 songs. Our brains are mashed potatoes right now, says Maroney, who plays me the new songs, which may or may not all end up on the album. She accompanies herself on guitar, sometimes pausing to scroll through the lyrics on her phone. No one outside of this house has heard them before. Turning to the magazine's Encore section, "Funk is making something out of nothing." The Last Word, Bootsy Collins. The legendary bassist on Lessons from James Brown, The Perils of Faking the Funk, and How Kamala Harris Helped Reunite Him with George Clinton. The Interview. Question: what's the best part of success? Bootsy Collins: experimenting. When you're out there with your instrument, being your instrument, music comes to you freely. It's like gifts, and then you give them away. But getting $2 or $3 helps, too. Question: what about the worst? Collins: once Frankenstein has built that monster, you can't control it. You want to spend time with your family. But everything moves so fast when you start to succeed, and this monster comes in and eats everybody up. That and the business. James Brown told me that it's 75% business, 25% music. I wasn't trying to hear that because I'm in love with the music. Question: James used to ask people to call him Mr. Brown. Did you ever ask people to call you Mr. Collins? Collins: oh, heck no. When people say Mr. Collins, I'm like, no, call me Bootsy. I want to always maintain that kid frame of mind. I don't ever want to grow up like that. I respect everybody, and if you don't respect me, that's cool. But to be going around making somebody call you Mr., that's pretty deep. Question: you titled your new record album, Album of the Year, number one, Funketeer. How do you know when you've made the album of the year? Collins: all the time I spent with P-Funk and James Brown, I've always seen everybody else get awards and accolades, and we never did. And so that made me be like, well, if you all are not going to say it, then I'm going to say it. It's just like Collins' 1978 album, Player of the Year. That wasn't no award until I made it one. Question: you always talked about funk like a religion. How important is the funk? Collins: funk is the word, and the word becomes flesh. If you don't got no funk, then you got no physical thing going on around here. We get 2 things. We get funk, and we get spirit. Man took whatever he find, made tools, made this, that, and the other, and made something out of nothing. But man wasn't the first. Funk was the first thing. Funk is making something out of nothing. Question: on your 1977 song, The Pinocchio Theory, you sang, "Don't fake the funk." Have you ever worried you were faking the funk? Collins: I promised myself that when it got to a point where I felt like I had to fake the funk, I would step down. I can never fake the funk. So when it came down to deciding to come off the road, the thought that came to me was, you can't keep carrying that bass like you've been doing on stage with those heavy clothes day in and day out. I was going to have to figure out another way. My other way is making albums of the year. I do more production, work now, and it makes me happy that I don't have to go out there and fake the funk, because a lot of people would. Question: what's the most indolent purchase you ever made? It would probably be 7 motorcycles, different ones, different styles, trail bikes, The Boot Cycle. That's the one you see on the cover of 1976 Stretching Out album. It wasn't just a prop, it was actually a motorcycle. I used to ride it around in L.A. I had the black leather suit with studs and rhinestones on it, wind in the hair, no helmet. To have two or three chicks in the back, it was the best. I was so blitzed out on drugs. That was the best time, other than being on stage. Question, you stopped riding in 1983 when you had a motorcycle accident. How did that change your life? Collins, the doctor told me I'd never use my right arm again. He was saying, you would never be able to play your bass again. And I was like, no. He said, all you got to do is rehab, rehab, and rehab. It took about a year before I realized I could use my arm again. Cocaine was the cause of my accident, because that's what I changed over to from LSD. George Clinton loved it. They used to call him Chief Cokehead. We used to go fishing in Miami out on the yachts, and he'd have his ounce of cocaine. I'd have my guitar, I'd play, he'd be humming songs. Poles be in the water, we'd be fishing. And the next thing you know, oh, you got one, you got one. Those were truly the fun days. Question. You spent most of the 1970s and early 1980s playing with George Clinton in P-Funk. Now you're working with him again. What's the secret to healing that friendship? Collins. The business tore us up, and I lost track of what was going on with him. But now things are feeling good. We're easing ourselves back in. I seen Kamala Harris on TV saying, I found a George Clinton doll, and I love Bootsy Collins. For some reason, that touched me. Like, he's still your friend, no matter what happened, and you got to be the one to take the high road. So I called him and said, let's do this track together. And he was all over it. So we're going to carry on and see where we go, because when you're dealing with the funk, you never know what the funk's going to happen. In the reviews section of the magazine, Lucy Dacus is going to break your heart. One of indie rock's best young songwriters trades coming-of-age dramas for adult-specific love songs on a stellar LP. I'm thinking about breaking your heart someday soon, Lucy Dacus confesses in Limerence, one of the highlights on her fourth album, Forever is a Feeling. It's a twisted supper club piano ballad where she's munching popcorn with friends who smoke weed and play Grand Theft Auto. But the Virginia indie rock troubadour croons as if she's living out a lush life fantasy of Hollywood romance. When she delivers that line about breaking someone's heart, she gives it a twist. And if I do, I'll be breaking mine too. It's startling to hear Dacus switch gears like that in her warmly familiar voice, earnest, mournful, calm, even when she's tormented. Dacus stretches out on Forever is a Feeling at a moment when she's at her most high profile. It's her first album since she conquered the world with Boy Genius, teaming up with two of the only indie peers anywhere near her level, Julian Baker and Phoebe Bridgers. The record had three radically different singer-songwriters blending their voices to come up with new kinds of magic. Dacus's We're in Love was a brilliant heart crippler on par with Triple Dog Dare from her masterful 2021 musical memoir Home Video. Forever takes a different approach, going for adult-specific love songs rather than the coming-of-age and coming-out tales that made her name. These songs take place in the middle of long-running, messy relationships, some desperately romantic, some just painful. Best Guess might be the most hopeful song she's done yet, singing, you're my best guess at the future. If I were a gambling man, and I am, you'd be my best bet. She gets vocal help from comrades like Bartice Strange and J-Sum's Melania Duarte, telling her, Imorata, you may not be an angel, but you are my girl. Bridgers and Baker pitch in with backup vocals elsewhere. When Dacus first arrived, she was a Southern indie kid with a shy voice, yet with her own steely onstage charisma. It was a revelation to see her get up in a bar and sing her solo acoustic version of Bruce Springsteen's Dancing in the Dark, turning it into the tale of an anxious queer teen in the sticks, hating what she sees in the mirror, but gearing up her courage to go face the great big world. Her sophomore gem, Historian, in 2018, stopped you dead in your tracks with Night Shift, turning a stupid coffee get-together with an ex into an unforgettable, intense, 7-minute soliloquy of revenge and guilt. All over forever, she aims for intimate drama. If the devil's in the details, then God is in the gap in your teeth, she sings in the song For Keeps. In the jubilant title song, she takes a romantically charged road trip over a sped-up piano, recalling, "We were cherry red in your forest green 1993 Grand Cherokee." Bullseye is a duet with Hoosier, where she pines for a guitar-playing mailman. "I miss borrowing your books to read your notes in the margins," Hoosier purrs to her harmonies. Lost Time and Big Deal are more downbeat acoustic ballads. Most Wanted Man is the album's only guitar rocker and easily its most urgent track sonically, a Birds-style rave where she's on a mission to catch the most wanted man in West Tennessee. Dacus does a lot of self-conscious playing with cliches on Forever, a trick that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, as in the dud Come Out, which uses over-the-top harp glissande as a camp punchline. But it works beautifully in Ankles, where she sings about libidinal frustration over staccato cellos asking, "What if we don't touch? What if we only talk about what we want and cannot have, and I'll throw a fit?" The tension builds until it explodes in the chorus, "Pull me by the ankles to the edge of the bed," with surprisingly poignant 80s synth burbles. Near the end of the song, she muses, "How lucky we are to have so much to lose." It could be a motto for Dacus looking back on her amazing first decade and looking at the unlimited future ahead. Also in reviews, the Elton John and Brandi Carlile's loving collaboration. The album Elton John and Brandi Carlile, Who Believes in Angels, Interscope. Elton John retired from touring in 2023, and last year he experienced a serious health care involving his vision. But for an artist with his work ethic and drive, slowing down was never really an option. In fact, his latest collaborative album with country maverick Brandi Carlile is a heartwarming burst of rejuvenation and reflection. Elton has always been one of the music's most avid collaborators. His last album was the all-star Lockdown Sessions, and his best album of this century is arguably 2010's The Union, a gracious set with Leon Russell. Here, the vibe is similarly sweet. To Get It Done, Bernie Taupin, producer Andrew Watt, and backing musicians like Chad Smith of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Pino Pallaudino of Nine Inch Nails, and guitarist Josh Klinghoffer flesh out of a sound that harkens to classic Elton without feeling like nostalgic throwbacks. They happily return to the early 70s glories of LPs like Tumbleweed Connection and Madman Across the Water, on ballads like Never Too Late and Who Believes in Angels, two sweeping songs about getting the most out of life in the face of mortality. Two songs use different settings to look back at musical heroes. Album opening, The Rose of Laura Nyro, is a candle in the wind-sized tribute to an Elton contemporary whose genre-bridging folk soul pop is a clear influence on Brandi Carlile. That's followed by Little Richard's Bible, a glam soul stomp driven by Elton's killer boogie-woogie piano. The best duet performance is the album's most youthfully upbeat, the rhinestone rock splurge Swing for the Fences. Brandi Carlile's acoustic detour, You Without Me, recalls the intimate indie folk of Elliott Smith or Boy Genius. They close it out with Elton's solo ballad, When This Old World Is Done With Me, looking honestly at the last stage of his incredible life. When this old world is done with me, he sings, just know I came this far to be broken up in pieces, scatter me among the stars. But this lovingly wrought record shows how much he has to give us in the here and now. Also in reviews, Justin Vernon lingers in the light. Bon Iver, the album Sable Fable. After a six-year hiatus, indie music elder statesman Justin Vernon finds lightness on his latest album, Sable Fable. Early on, Short Story is perhaps the most reminiscent of Bon Iver's recent work. The track, closing in at just under 2 minutes, is layered with a company of familiar synths, brass outfits, and vocoders all cascading on top of one another. The song shimmers seamlessly into Everything is Peaceful, Love, the single that stands as the thesis of Fable. Vernon's harmonies ascend up a scale over a metronome-like beat as if he's carefully keeping time, determined to hold a steady pace as he revels in the qualms of new love. There's a sense of transcendence here, with most songs resolving in a major key, carried by propulsive percussion and a whole lot of pedal steel. On Things Behind Things, Vernon states that, I would like the feeling gone. On There's a Rhythm, he asks a crucial question, can I feel another way? With Sable Fable, ominously touted by his label as Bon Iver's epilogue, Justin Vernon is ready to break the murky cycle of sadness and heartbreak and to walk into the light. This concludes the reading of the Rolling Stone magazine in the April 2025 edition. To be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.